side of a city where women weren't supposed to meet strangers on their own, yet still had to contend with annoyances like feeding themselves and not freezing in the street. Blaze had a ready-made reason to accompany her, and to go armed. When the hour came, they walked down the dark streets to the public house and went upstairs to the appointed room on the third floor. Blaze made sure the shutters were cracked open, wishing they'd done this on the second floor instead. Much easier to land a jump without breaking a leg from 10 feet up instead of 20. There wasn't even any good garbage below them. Major oversight on his part. Min wasn't exactly helpless, though. And he'd added a few tricks to his own repertoire. Kept forgetting that. Footsteps carried down the hall. A bearded man opened the door a hand's width, glanced at Blaze and Min, and opened the door the rest of the way. A thin woman entered. Her brown hair was unusually short. She had the worn look of someone whose life is spent at the behest of others, scuffed and chipped about her edges like an old table. But there was nothing dull in her eyes. She turned to the man and nodded. "I'll be right outside." Reluctantly, he exited, leaving the door slightly ajar. Min clinked a small pouch on the table. "Thank you for coming to see me. You can't buy your way into the pillars." The woman stared at the pouch, then swept it up. "If you're worthy, they'll see it." She seated herself with a short glance at Blaze. Min scooted her chair forward. "What do they consider worthy?" "Foremost, trust." "As in a letter of recommendation?" The woman laughed. "Candidates spend 3 months in a barracks in the hills before they're even allowed into the pillars. There you will be taught to obey without question. To anticipate your master's wants before he has them. To serve the servants of the heavens, you must learn to work in harmony." "I've heard even the heavens aren't so harmonious these days." "I doubt it's as dire as you've been told," she said dryly. "So it is out of balance," Min said. "Would it be a poor time to approach the endless pillars?" "That matter will be resolved before you're out of the barracks." "Then they're near a solution?" At his place at the wall, Blaze held his breath. The woman turned down the corners of her mouth. "The pillars are a foundry of wonders. Those who cannot set down their curiosity have no place there." Smartly, Min backed off, asking what the application process was like. It sounded very involved and might have been fascinating under different circumstances, but Blaze had the distinct impression they'd already gotten as close to their answers as they were going to in this conversation. Still, they paid their money. It was possible that the woman, who'd refused to give her name, might drop something they could follow up on elsewhere. Besides, quitting early would only draw suspicion. After close to an hour, Min nodded to herself, appearing to absorb the woman's last response. She gazed at her hands. "This has been extremely helpful. Do you know anyone else who might be willing to talk?" "This isn't the sort of thing we're supposed to do. I'm only here because of my boy." "I understand, but I have the impression I'll only have one chance to get this right." "We'll see about that," the woman said. She went to the door and exited. The bearded man glanced inside, then followed her down the hall. "I'm sorry," Min said quietly. "She wasn't the type to feed us what we wanted on a platter," Blaze said. "Anyway, we learned a few things, such as the fact you shouldn't actually try to join the staff. The hunt for Selen will be over before you even graduate to the pillars." "I feel like I should have gotten more." "You are the one talking about how silly this is, and the king's intestines and so forth. Come on, what else did we learn?" "But even the servants know something is happening." She rested her chin on her fists. "What if all they've found is knowledge? How do we take that away from them?" "We could try removing their heads." "We need an inside source. I don't see any way around it. He didn't either. About the only way to get one of those was to kidnap and torture a wizard, a sticky endeavor, or bribe their way up the staff. Right now, his single connection to that staff was an unnamed woman who might or might not have one of her friends talk to them later. He didn't like that. But he didn't have any other resources to pursue. They were starting from scratch. You can only build so quickly without the walls falling in on you. During the next few days of waiting, he thought about going to Taya and seeing what she could turn up. He knew she'd be happy to help, but that was the problem. He didn't want to drag her into this. Investigating the endless pillars was like poking a hornet's nest. One where the hornets could summon invisible spears and kill you twice before you had the chance to think, oh dear, this was an error in judgment. Taya had no business with that. He'd already exposed her to an unnecessary dimension of danger when Dante had come calling. Blaze didn't intend to repeat his mistakes. So he and Min took the slow route. She made the rounds of the pubs, spreading the word that she'd pay well to be able to talk with any of the pillar's servants. One time, they went back to the hills to gaze on the grounds and brainstorm a way to break in, but the core problem remained the same. Even if they got inside, they wouldn't know what they were looking for. It did, however, give him one idea. Spy on the place from afar, and when one of the big fish emerged to take a trip to the palace, Min could shadow walk in behind them to eavesdrop on whatever conversation the king had summoned them for. It was a little on the crazy side, but if nothing panned out on the servant front, he thought it could work. They didn't turn up any more servants, but 5 days after Min's interview with the woman, they checked in at the inn where they'd met with her and found a note waiting. She had a friend who was willing to talk, a person who had been with the pillars for almost 2 decades. Through notes, Blaze scheduled another late-night meet, this time at an inn within spitting distance of the Street of Kings. They arrived early and headed up to the room. 4th floor this time. Everything lower had been sold out. Blaze pried open the shutters and took a look at the side of the building. No fire ladders or anything like that, but decorative iron rails hung above the windows would make climbing down a little easier. Below, a coin jingled across the flagstones. A man walked over to pick it up. As he crouched down, a sword angled from his belt. His cloak swung open, revealing a flash of red. In the window, Blaze went still. The man walked back into the shadows of the building across from the inn. Blaze picked out 2 more men hidden in the gloom. He touched the hilts of his swords. We have to get out of here. Min glanced over her shoulder. What's wrong? He'll be here any minute. I doubt that. I think the only attendees of this soiree will be 12 armed guards. She was about to say something, but rustling noises sounded from the hall. She popped up and slipped the door's bolts into its lock. She had no sooner removed her hand from it when the door rattled softly. Someone banged on the other side. Open up and lay down your arms! Blaze peered around the edge of the window. The guards in the alley were staring up at the room. If he and Min tried to climb down, they'd be hacked to ribbons. From the hall, a guard slammed into the door, splintering the frame. Blaze's heart hammered. One more bash would knock it wide open. Before he could reach for his swords, and to his great surprise, he disappeared. Chapter 27 The stories from the cycle of Jaren are more than stories, Dante said. They're a history of a land that was changed forever. You're talking about Wesley, Lou said. Long ago there was a flood, one beyond our comprehension. Maybe it began as a thunderstorm, I don't know. I only know that the people in Moreave tried to wait it out in the basement, and all were drowned. Except a few who made it to the roof. I don't know what happened to them. They left one message. Aron's mill has fallen, and the waters of heaven fell to earth with it. Dante gestured into the gorge he'd carved in the ground. Those trees down there weren't washed here by the flood. They grew here. This land used to be a forest. How do you know that? C said. Talking to ghosts in the basement, were you? Because Ellen used to be a desert. The echoes are full of sand. Something caused it to stop raining here and start raining there. He paused, then spat it out. I believe that something is the Woden's. Lou's brow crinkled. I don't get it. They're mountains. Proverbial for being eternal. I think that someone, maybe Aron himself, created the Wodens to separate Garsk from Wesley. That's why everything here is so strange. In an instant, everything was changed, not just the people, but the lands themselves. If you know how to listen, you can still hear the echoes of the way it used to be. Garsk seems to have survived just fine. And if this is true, why don't we have any accounts of the giant mountain range Aron erected to stop the children from fighting? I don't know, Dante said. Maybe there are marks on Garsk. We've never known to look. Sombra laughed, the laugh of a man who's seen through a card trick. This is why the minister means to invade Narashtivik. He blames us for the devastation of Wesley. That's insane. We didn't rain cataclysm on this place. Even if we had, it's been centuries since then. And memory lives no longer than people. Then why do we dress in Aron's colors and devote our lives to a book written 1,000 years before we were born? Dante was about to protest they didn't go to war over such things, then remembered Samarand had done just that. In response to another set of ancient beliefs. All fires need fuel. Even if he thinks Narashtivik is to blame, we haven't had regular contact with Wesley since before the Cycle of Jaren was written. Sombra smiled. They're reminded of our crime every day. Do you think they lived in those trees before the mountains existed? What do you think caused them to fear the ground in the first place? That sounds impossible, but there's an unsettling consistency to it. C tucked her thumbs into her belt. Then, unless you want Narashtivik to get relocated 20,000 feet straight up, it sounds like we better go kill the minister. So one of his subordinates can grab Selen instead, Dante said. The only way to ensure our safety is to take the Black Star for ourselves. Which we still have no idea how to do. We'll head back to Ellen, see what else Horace wasn't telling us, then return to Call and find out how the minister intends to find Selen. Lou raised his hand. Should we tell Horace his people are gearing up to fight the wrong war? We owe them nothing, Sombra said. Let them remain a needle in the minister's mattress. Dante glanced up at the afternoon sun. There's no reason to linger. We have to get back to Call as fast as we can. They packed up their camp and were on their way north in minutes. Going back to Ellen and then to Call would take them on an L-shaped trip, and Dante was tempted to skip Ellen altogether and cut straight from Moreave to Call. But they had no map, nor road to show them the way. For all they knew, the desert persisted 200 miles to the west. They could easily get lost, die of thirst. Now wasn't the time to take unnecessary chances. With no roots or stones to trip over, they continued walking after nightfall, stopping once they grew tired. The next day they reached the village and stopped to refresh their water and exchange greetings. The people tried to rope them into another feast, but Dante no longer had the luxury of luxuries. As he walked away, he looked back over his shoulder. Perhaps the council should give up its politicking and prestige and wander the lands healing the sick. It felt better than most of what Dante had been involved in since leaving Malon. There were no hard choices in it. No liras. No one could accuse you of causing harm. But he and the Council of Narashtivik were responsible for the freedom of the Norrin, the revitalization of the city, and, at long last, its independence. None of that could have happened if they'd retired from the world.
Somba's right about the minister, Ast said once the village was a mile behind them. He blames Narashtivik for what happened.
Everyone turned to him. C spoke first. You're from Kaul, aren't you?
He shook his head. I'm from the lands that used to be the Wodans.
You knew this all along, Dante said. Why didn't you tell us?
I didn't know the minister's plans, and I intended to betray you, to take some small measure of vengeance for what your people did to mine.
Wind swept through the stunted yellow grass. Lou looked around for help.
I assume you've changed your mind?
I don't know if Narashtivik is responsible for the disaster.
Ast gestured behind them toward the village by the lake.
If so, you're different from your ancestors who slaughtered mine.
Where does that leave you? Dante said.
If the minister means to cause a second cataclysm, to repeat that event that ruined the Elsin, then, as a descendant of the Elsin, I am sworn to stop him.
The tall man met Dante's eyes.
Don't make me regret it.
They pushed themselves hard on the road back to Elsin. Dante gave some thought to stealing horses, but they would somehow have to steal saddles as well. Additionally, he didn't want to spoil Ast's respect for him and the city he represented. Perhaps it was foolish to delay themselves over one man's opinion when an entire city hung in the balance, but Dante didn't have the heart, or lack of it, to do different. He looned Nak to explain what they'd found. Nak and Ollivander were flabbergasted.
You know we have no records of any such events, Ollivander said.
Dante flapped his arms at the patchy desert.
Maybe it predates us. And the cycle.
All I know is what I saw. Anyway, it doesn't matter what the truth is. It matters what the minister believes.
Ollivander was quiet a moment.
I'm beginning to think I should dispatch a second team to assist you.
Dante laughed.
Anyone who volunteers for that needs to be committed to an asylum. And you need a small army to get past the Kappas. No way to bring a troop like that into Spiren without the minister noticing.
I was afraid you'd say that.
Don't get too close to him.
Get what you need and get out fast.
That's my goal. How are your preparations going?
Deliberately, Ollivander said. We've made progress, but if we move too fast, we risk alarming Setevan. If we were to then explain why we're mustering our forces, and that he has no cause for worry, the king might be tempted to take advantage of our situation, either by striking us or recapturing the Norrin. It's a slippery path.
Dante had been so wrapped up in his own problems, he hadn't given any thought to the political consequences of the minister's plans. The raising of an army was a tough thing to conceal. Modigan might well react by expanding his own forces. Even if Narashtivik were able to resist the minister's invasion, they might be so weakened they'd be helpless against an opportunistic strike from Setevan. They left the desert and entered the prairie. Elsin resolved to the north. They could hear the blare of its morning horns from 10 miles away. They passed through the maze-like gates. On the hopes of not spending a single night in the city, the group hurried straight to an entrance to the Echoes. While the others hung about in a plaza to make use of a fountain and water the ponies, Dante and Ast headed into the caverns. Dante didn't want Casey to see him, let alone talk to him, and he and Ast holed up in a mostly intact sandstone building down the street from her little rebel band. He was trying to think of a way to pass a message to Horace without attracting attention, when luck smiled on them, and the bald man exited the house on a course toward one of the stairways. Dante allowed him a small head start, putting Casey's house behind them, then jogged to catch up. At the sound of his footsteps, Horace glanced back. He looked surprised to see Dante, but not especially wary, and Dante was able to convince him to talk inside the shelter of a crumbling house.
"Did you find what you were looking for?"
Horace said.
"We did," Dante said. "Why send us all the way to Moreave? Why not simply tell me what happened?"
"Would you have believed me if you hadn't seen it with your own eyes?"
"Probably not. But if you'd tried, you might have saved us 2 weeks. Anyway, how did you know I'd be able to expose the trees?"
Horace tipped back his head.
"Expose the trees? Didn't you see the canyon? The houses and its sides buried under 50 feet of clay and sand?"
"We didn't see anything like that. Maybe the sands have filled it in."
Outside, someone was crunching down the street. Dante waited for them to pass. "What's done is done. Now I need to know everything you know concerning the minister's knowledge of Selen."
"I don't know anything about that. I'm sorry. You should speak to Jotam again. He's the one who's been keeping an eye on the minister."
"Since when did the monks of Dirisen get so political?" Ast asked.
"Since politics became hijacked by madmen," Horace replied.
"Enough," Dante said. "We're all lashed to the same wagon. We'll ask Jotam about Selen, but is there anything else you can tell us that might help us deal with the minister?"
Horace folded his hands and stared at the gritty floor of the half-ruined house.
"Again, this is an issue for Jotam. I am a long way from Korl, and he will know your details most fit to help your cause. But I know a story that may be of use."
"Wonderful," C said, settling in.
"Quiet," Dante said.
"Right now, everything is useful to us, Horace."
"Very well," he said. "I believe Casey told you the minister is from Ellen."
"She did. Which makes it odd that he has so much legitimacy in Spiron."
"There are two reasons for that. The first is that his family also has strong roots in Spiron. I can't recite the precise course of their lineage, but his branch of the tree is fed with royal sap. His claim to the crown is legitimate. Ironically, that legitimacy became a stumbling block. The minister had eyes on ascending the top loft, but his brother Dovin got there first, marrying the Lady Ansel, heir to the Spirish throne."
C frowned. "First I've heard of either of them."
Horace chuckled darkly. "Not without reason. This was a typical Ellenite marriage, meant to strengthen Camran ties to Spiron and broaden the rivers of trade. Great wealth was poured into preparations for the wedding, and even more was exchanged, securing deals for lorebells, Spirish lumber, and Camrish iron. Both sides invested much, and anticipated they would profit even more. The minister knew this. As the wedding neared, he invited Dovin down to the Echoes, claiming he had unearthed a great treasure he wished to give Dovin as a wedding gift. The two brothers descended to these very caves."
Horace's eyebrows bent.
"Later that day, the minister emerged, alone and dazed. There had been a cave-in. Dovin was dead. The arrangements lay in ruins. Not just the wedding, but the entire Spirish-Camrish alliance. Until the minister volunteered to marry the Lady Ansel in his brother's stead."
C gaped. "He killed his own brother?"
"No one knows that but the minister. Ansel had been in love with Dovin, and wanted nothing to do with his younger brother, but it wasn't a situation in which he was given a voice. She and the minister were married. For 3 years, their relationship remained as cold as the tips of the Wodens. Then Ansel fell from the top loft. Some claimed it was a suicide. The minister investigated it himself. He declared it was true,
his wife had killed herself, and he was so heartbroken that he couldn't stand hearing her name ever again.
He killed his wife too, Dante said.
That's what many of the Spirish nobles believed, Horace said. Murder, suicide, accident. Any of these was possible. Whatever the truth, the minister's decree soon blotted her from history.
Much like Morrieve.
Precisely. At the same time, the minister stepped up his xenophobia, accusing Ellen of dishonest dealing, whipping up his people with tales from the past. With his fist curled firmly around his people, his power consolidated, all whispers of Ansel ceased.
I'm not sure I understand, Dante said. Are you suggesting we can exploit the cracks in the Spirish nobility?
Horace leaned back and spread his hands. This was many years ago. Ansel's friends and family have long since died, resigned, or bent their neck to the minister's yoke. Happily so in many cases. I don't tell you this to exploit a rift. The minister made sure that was impossible. I tell you this so you can understand the man you seek to face. He knows his goals. He will do anything to achieve them, and he will neutralize all consequences before you know how to react.
That marked the end of their talk. Dante thanked Horace and returned to street level with Ast. With nothing to keep them in Ellen, they struck west toward the lands of Spiron and the sky-spanning Wodans.
What exactly are the Dirison? Dante said, once they were settled and on their way. What's their role in this?
I can't say I've kept up with the interregional Wesleyan politics, Ast said. But the Dirison have always been devoted to the preservation of knowledge. They consider it humanity's greatest accomplishment and the only treasure worth seeking. The one thing that sets us apart from the animals. The only way we'll ever rise above our base nature.
Sounds like you admire them, C said.
When I was younger and full of anger, I joined one of their shrines, hoping to calm myself and find my way. All I wound up learning was their life was not for me.
So you have no idea what their involvement is, Dante said.
Ast hunched his shoulders in a broad shrug.
I left them years ago. I barely know what Selen is myself. I couldn't begin to guess what the Dirison are doing.
Dante supposed they'd be able to ask Yotam in a few days. In the meantime, they needed to think about how to operate in a land they'd been forbidden from re-entering under penalty of death. They weren't going to be able to stay in Korl. There was too little private space. It wasn't like a typical city with numerous ways in and out and countless streets and back alleys to make use of in lieu of the major boulevards. Each section of the city had, in essence, a single connective street, the stairway up the trunk, which was patrolled by soldiers and interrupted by toll bridges. They'd have to keep their use of these to a bare minimum. That meant finding shelter outside the city. After much discussion, they decided to sell the three remaining ponies. They had a lot of ground to cross in Spiron, and ditching their mounts was the only good way to alter the composition of their party. Besides, they no longer needed to carry enough supplies to last them through a long journey into unknown lands. Selen would appear somewhere in the Wodans, Dante was sure of it. Once they learned exactly how to find and take it, they would only need to carry enough blankets and food to get to it and take it to Sol. They could sorely use money for bribes and such, too. So, as they plodded west, they checked in at villages and towns, gauging the market for the three beasts. Somba predicted offer prices would increase as they grew closer to the mountains. This proved true. As they neared the borders of Cameron and Spiron, they sold all three to a man who made regular trade excursions into the forested hills. The price was less than Dante had hoped for, but it was sizable enough, and with the Lorens providing free food and shelter, they'd be able to save all of it for buying information. As they neared Spiron, Dante knocked a rabbit dead and infused it with the nether. He sent it loping down the road, its little black eyes sharp for any sign of soldiers. The nights were generally too overcast for travel, particularly when the road ran along the sides of the yawning east-west canyons, canyons that, Dante now knew, must have been carved during the disaster that had washed away Moreave and brought life to Ellen. Whenever they approached the city, Lauren, they looped through the woods until it was well behind them. There were a fair amount of travelers on the road, but Dante simply declined all attempts to engage their group in conversation. The closer they got to Coral, the more often patrols of soldiers forced them to vacate the road. Twice, full companies marched past wearing forest green uniforms and carrying pikes and bows. While Dante and the others hid hundreds of yards inside the woods, the undead rabbit watched the troops go by. Dante relayed everything he saw to Ollivander, who was thrilled to finally receive some hard details of what Narashtovic might face in the field. Once they arrived within 10 miles of Coral, they found an unoccupied lorren and installed themselves in one of its lower rounds. Dante used a team of dead rabbits and squirrels to scout for a secluded tree closer to the city. With the forest extending to all sides, they were able to find an empty lorren tucked behind a hill, a mile from Coral. As night fell, Dante penned a note and tied it around the neck of one of the squirrels. It bounded across the woods toward Coral. It took Dante some time to find the tree with the owl carved into its trunk. The beast dashed up the tree's roots and climbed straight up the trunk to the fourth loft. There, the shrine's conical roof stood out from the leaves like a mast against the sea. The squirrels snuck across the flat and Dante guided it around the structure, looking for a hole or an open window. In the end, he had to send it through the chimney, which was in use, but the dead squirrel registered the smoke and heat without slowing down. Monks snored within their cells, doors left open to coax warm air from the central fireplace. The squirrel went room to room, standing over each monk until Dante identified Jotun. The squirrel hopped up on the man's desk, chewed through the string around its neck, and deposited Dante's note. With its first task complete, he sent it back out the fireplace. Its claws slipped on the bricks, and the stink of singed fur filled his nose. It regained its footing and scrabbled up into the night air. Dante had it take a look at itself. The tip of its tail was burnt, but it looked intact enough to pass for a living creature. He sent it racing along the flats to the minister's tree. There it climbed higher and higher, until it looked down on the palace. Candles burned in the windows. Guards patrolled the walkways. Mostly they hung around the stairway, but they were canny enough to glance up into the branches now and then. For the moment, he left his scout outside the buildings of the palace. He wanted to talk to Jotun before he began snooping around the ministers. The man must have nethermancers of his own, otherwise Selin would surely be beyond his reach. Back in their lorren, they tacked brown blankets across the entrance of the round. The night was frigid, and they had no fire, and their combined body heat in the small space kept it bearable. When they got up, they plucked lorbells from the branches, eating these rather than dipping into their supplies of dry food. Dante posted a couple of squirrels in the trees a few hundred yards closer to Coral to watch the approach. He and the others kept to their tree, leaving the round as little as possible. That afternoon, a man walked across the forest floor. His clothes were of the Spirish fashion, but they were plain brown, and while many people accented the bands around their wrists and shins with colorful thread, precious metals, or small charms, his were twine. He was shaved bald, but his face was bearded with white bristles. Dante climbed down the tree and moved to intercept Jotun before he could see exactly where they were staying. They paused, 20 feet apart, on the mushy bed of mushy leaves. Jotun inclined his head.
I didn't think we'd see each other again. I wouldn't be back to tempt the minister's wrath unless it were urgent, Dante said. The night we were supposed to meet, what did you intend to tell me?
Jotun's eyes crinkled. That would have depended on what kind of person I judged you to be. When the minister's men came for us, I knew you would be cast from Spiron, or worse. I could only hope to send you to my friend instead.
We met him. He's embedded with a group convinced the minister means to invade Ellen. They wound up tangling with his agents. Horace was wounded and near death, but I was able to heal him.
Then I am most glad you were able to find him.
Eventually.
Dante's eyebrows crept together.
You might have mentioned his address was underground.
The monk shrugged. I had nothing but his address myself.
Why were you willing to speak to me in the first place?
Because you're from Narashtovik. Of all the minister's many hatreds, that one burns the hottest.
If he'd learned it's your homeland,
he would have given you a swift and public execution.
Why do you care? Why are your people at odds with the minister?
Do you know who my people are?
The Derison, Dante said.
Like the Hanassans of Garsk,
collectors of wisdom.
Of knowledge, the monk corrected. Knowledge is the only way mankind might be saved.
That makes the minister our most bitter enemy.
Champion of ignorance, is he?
The latest in a long line of them. To the Derison, his crime is without compare. The extermination of all knowledge of the greatest calamity to ever befall the known world.
Dante's blood ran cold. A wave of prickles ran down his spine.
The raising of the Wodans.
Jotun's brows shot up.
You know?
After an absurd amount of legwork. I don't know what's harder to believe, the story itself, or that it's possible to erase it from history.
How much do you know about what the world was like before you were born? Can you name a single king from 1,000 years ago? A single kingdom?
The old man gazed across the cold woods.
Now imagine that a single-minded group has spent the last 1,000 years destroying all knowledge of that forgotten monarch.
Well, they've done a damn good job. I didn't understand what I was seeing until I went to Mori for myself. I've never heard a whisper of the cataclysm in Garsk.
That's where the Spirish worked hardest. To them, you're demon spawn. When the day comes for them to strike, they want you ignorant of everything, especially their intention to destroy you.
You talk like this is something that won't happen for hundreds of years, Dante said. But it's happening now.
The minister isn't preparing to attack Ellen at all, is he?
Selen's returned, and he's about to find it.
He'll use it to tear down the mountains. With a clear path, he'll unleash his legions on Narashtovik. Can you help me get it before him?
The old man pursed his mouth. What will you do with it?
I certainly won't use it to destroy Spiron.
Nor to improve your skill at dodging questions. Even Selen couldn't make you any better at that.
To live forever, Dante said. If I can.
Jotun looked him up and down. You sorcerers are so predictable.
Is there something wrong with not wanting to die?
Not especially, except that it contradicts Aron's will.
If he wants me, he'll take me.
Do you find my cause unworthy?
It could use some work, the monk said, but I suppose it's better than genocide. Here's the truth. I don't know much about how to find what you seek. The minister and his ancestors have spent centuries gathering that information up, then destroying all trace of it in the world. Logically, he'll have stored what he's found in his crow's nest.
Dante frowned. I was brought there when his men came for me. But if I tried to return, I would be escorted off the nearest branch.
Did you get much of a look round?
Our meeting was on the hasty side, not to mention hostile. I was occupied watching his hands for knives.
Yotam waved at a fly that had somehow survived the winter.
In the past he's called me in to borrow my expertise as the city's elder monk of Dirison. Naturally, the information doesn't flow both ways. But I couldn't help noticing one of his rooms is papered with strange drawings, squiggles, striations, abstract lines. After a couple hours pretending I wasn't staring at it, I finally figured out what I was looking at. A bird's-eye view of certain regions of the Woden Mountains.
You think he's mapped out where Selin will manifest?
Yotam spread his palms.
There were historical notes pinned to the maps. Once I understood what they were, I didn't try to learn more. If he'd caught me spying, the minister would have murdered me.
Notes like that would be irrelevant to a mining operation or a battle plan.
Dante gazed in the rough direction of the tree that housed the minister's palace. The canopy was much too dense to see through, but he knew it was there, looming over the woods.
I can get a look without exposing myself, but even if I know where to look, I won't know what to do when I found it.
Haven't you heard the legends? Yotam said, eyes twinkling. All you have to do is find the black star in a night sky.
Dante thanked him, and the monk wandered away, taking a circuitous path through the forest. Dante returned to the Lauren and laid out what he'd been told.
I can send in animals to get a look at the maps, he said. Asked, if I transcribe them, do you think you'll recognize the locations?
Ast folded his arms, tapping his thumb against his elbow.
I know the Wodens better than most, but they're far too big for any man to know completely.
If Yotam was able to recognize the maps, I'm sure you'll know what they cover.
Perhaps I'll turn up more clues when I'm poking around.
Two of us have work, then, Somba said. What about the rest?
Dante rubbed his mouth.
Too risky. If the minister catches you, there's no telling what he'll do.
This is a waste of talent. Kelly once posed as a member of the council, the finest nethermancers in Narashtovik, and duped all of them.
You heard about that, Dante laughed. And once I did, I made him teach me.
Why does that not surprise me?
If you think you can contribute, I trust your judgment.
Please, be careful.
What about me?
Lou said.
Dante glanced his way.
Help keep watch. My eyes will be too focused on the minister to watch my back.
Lou didn't look happy about his unengaging assignment, but he said no more. The meeting dissolved. C walked onto the flat to bunker down in the leaves and keep watch on the woods.
Somber stepped out of the round. A minute later, a goat herder from the village north of Moriv walked inside.
Satisfied? The man said in Somber's voice.
Dante laughed.
Well, I never doubted you.
Somber parted the blankets hung from the doorway. His boots scraped on the roots as he climbed down to the ground. Dante moved his mind back into the senses of the squirrel. It was still attached to a branch overlooking the minister's compound. Its layout was hardly less confusing by daylight than when Dante had first been frog-marched into it in the middle of the night. The entire loft was barnacled with structures, fortifications, and a connective tissue of ropes and ladders. It could take days just to find the map room. But much of it could be ruled out at a glance. All of the smaller buildings, anything that was too easy to get to. Realistically, there were three good candidates. First, the dominant rectangular building that seemed to serve as the area's keep. It was noteworthy in that, unlike almost everything else on the level, it had no other structures adjacent to it, allowing it clear fields of fire were it ever besieged. The second suspect was a tower placed at the end of a flat. The branches above it were well pruned, offering a direct lookout across the surrounding trees, or up at the stars. An obvious haven for a nethermancer, or anyone inclined to strategizing. Third and last was the building Dante had been brought to on the night of their exile, a long, three-story construction on a flat with no connections to any other spoke of the tree. Its approach from the trunk was barred by a gated wall. The branches above it had been trimmed down so none remained large enough to support a person, but they were plenty strong for a squirrel. Given the minister's affection for curios, Dante thought he might keep the map room in that building, which seemed to be his personal quarters. He sent the squirrel hopping from branch to branch. Soldiers and courtiers strolled around, but none gave the animal any more attention than they did the diverse birds flitting about. The building was regal enough that all its windows were glass. This was a plus and a minus. It allowed many of the shutters to be left open despite the cold, meaning the squirrel could see inside, but the windows themselves were clamped shut. Oh well. It had chimneys, and if it came down to it, the squirrel could follow someone inside. In the meantime, Dante was content to have it crawl around and observe from outside. Within an hour, he'd ruled out all the rooms he could see into. But there were many he couldn't, due to shutters or being located away from the outer walls. After much hunting around, he found an open window in the kitchen and snuck inside. Proceeding on the assumption that most people don't care to find wild animals in domestic houses, particularly those persons tasked with keeping the house clean and orderly, he advanced the squirrel with great caution, tucking it beneath tables and chairs whenever footsteps or voices approached. Like all of Spiron, the decor was heavy on wood, but much of the palace's furniture and surfaces were covered in hammered copper. Most of the doors were left open. He covered the ground floor and moved up to the second. Halfway through his search, he heard the minister's voice receding down a hallway. He sent the squirrel after it, running along the rug to muffle its claws. The minister sat in a room whose bay windows overlooked the city below. He had a glass in his hand and, as before, was dressed all in black. To his side stood an older woman whose blonde hair was combed back from her forehead. She wrinkled her brow. "To cut to the quick, I'm concerned about the potential for floods." "I doubt that will be an issue," the minister said, without looking away from the window. "We're not bringing down the whole thing. We're opening a channel. Easier to defend if necessary. We've been over this." The woman clasped her hands, rubbing her palms together. "Of course, but Preslin raised an interesting point. We think a narrow channel might act as a sort of funnel for the clouds." The minister rolled his eyes. "So what? The roots will keep us safe, just like always." There was a pause. Dante moved the squirrel through the door, and behind a low-slung chair stained cherry red. The vantage gave him a good look at both of their faces. The woman appeared to suppress a frustrated sigh. "What about the people who live in the roots?"
"What a tremendous loss that would be, to see all our vagabonds and whores flushed away into the plains. Woe and anguish! With any luck, their bodies will wash straight to Ellen. Start a plague."
The minister had been speaking in a sing-songy, sarcastic tone, but he sat up, eyes slitted in thought. "Hang on. Is that something we could do?" The woman's eyes grew pained.
"Use the river to deluge Ellen with corpses?"
"Right. Pack them in like salmon bloating in the sun."
"For what purpose?"
"Well, to kill people. Weaken our enemies."
"You think this is something we need to do?"
The minister turned from the window. His eyes were a pale green, but rather than reminding Dante of cold seas or dying grass, they burned with the startling intensity of copper in a forge fire. He set down his glass.
I've had it with Ellen letting their people do whatever they please. Their citizens are interfering with my ability to get things done, and that is where I draw the line. A good plague will force their leaders to crack down. Disasters are always used to seize control.
Should I add this good plague to our never-ending list of tasks?
Survey the river all the way to Ellen. Ensure there's good flow under any bridges and no dams or other obstacles.
He raised one brow at her, and reassess your attitude, Ferrin, or I will find someone else capable of writing down the words I say.
Keeping her face blank, she managed a stiff bow, then departed. After he finished his drink, the minister walked from the room.
After that, Dante moved the squirrel from room to room. All it took was one glance to rule them out. He soon had taken a peek at every room but one, a large central chamber in the middle of the top floor. Its doors were closed, but by lurking behind a statue of an ancient warrior who wore fearsome claws strapped to his hands, the squirrel was able to hide until a servant went to the door. The squirrel padded in behind him. Skylights did a half-hearted job of illuminating the wide room.
Found it, Dante whispered inside the round.
You did, Blue said.
How can I help?
Make sure I have plenty of paper. I'm going to have to draw this myself.
Lou made some shuffling noises. Dante returned his attention to the squirrel.
Inside the palace, the servant fetched a bundle of papers and headed into the hallway. Dante waited for his steps to recede.
Just as Yotam had said, line drawings cover the walls, often from floor to ceiling. They made no obvious sense to Dante, but deciphering them was Ast's job. Dante was to copy them. This was painstaking labor. He was no artist, and the squirrel was so short that its perspective was skewed unless it climbed up on chairs and tables. Fortunately, the room was little used, and Dante found that he was regularly able to work for an hour or more without having to hide the squirrel from view. He filled sheet after sheet with scaled-down drawings. He didn't stop until it grew too dark to make out the maps. While Ast looked over the copies, Dante sat back against the interior of the trunk and rubbed his sore eyes.
It isn't contiguous, Ast declared after some minutes of study.
Dante's eyes flew open.
So you recognize it?
Their perspective is confusing, but some of the landmarks are obvious.
Do you see any directions?
He shook his head.
It feels like something's missing, doesn't it? Perhaps it will make more sense when it's complete.
Maybe it would. But Dante tried to stay up to catch Sombra anyway, hoping the man would bring back something useful. But wrangling the squirrel all day had been exhausting, and he fell asleep immediately after eating his dinner of free laurels.
A spike of sympathetic pain woke him before dawn. He moved his vision into the squirrels, just in time to see a disgusted-looking man draw back a candlestick and swing it.
Dante's second sight went black.
Something wrong?
Lou whispered from across the dark round.
Got my spy. But they didn't understand what it was. I've already got a replacement on the way.
Well, that's good, he said over C's snores. Speaking of, Somber came back keenly interested in something called the Spire of the Earths. He didn't say much, but...
Where is he now? Dante said.
He already went back to Coral. He's crazy, I think.
Silhouetted, Lou twisted his hands in his lap. I've been practicing at puppeting the animals, like you do. I thought I might send a squirrel or a mouse up to the spire and have a look around.
I don't think that's a great idea. I'll have the rest of the maps copied in another day or two. Then I can see about this Spire of the Earths.
I feel like I could be making better use of my time.
It's not about that, Dante said.
It's about getting this done right. No mistakes. Nothing else matters.
I suppose it doesn't.
Blue lapsed into silence. Dante sent a replacement squirrel up to the palace. As the skies lightened, he searched for an open window. This took far longer than it should have. So did the wait for a servant to enter the map room. By the time he had the new squirrel inside, it had cost him several hours. Dante bent to his work with equal parts frustration and vigor. A couple hours later, he reached out his hand for a new sheet of paper, but Lou had gone off somewhere. He stood to get it himself, and saw they were almost out of it. While he resumed copying the drawings on the walls, Ast studied the previous ones. C was out on the flats, watching the woods. Somba was gone doing whatever it was that Somba did when he was on his own, which probably involved thinking of new ways to trick people into walking off cliffs or poisoning themselves. As dusk fell, he filled his last sheet of paper. He'd copied 3 full walls, and started on the 4th. Someone was going to have to head into Coral for more supplies. Figuring Somba was already there, he loaned Knack and asked him to ask Somba to pick up more paper before coming back to the Lauren. Knack agreed and switched over to loon Somba. When he came back, his voice was high and on the edge of a quaver.
Somba said he was right about to loon you. It's Lou. He's been arrested.
Chapter 28. The room warped into a world of black and silver. In a daze between panic and hilarity, Blaze watched as the door burst open. He skipped back, swords out. Guards poured inside, leading the way with blades of their own, but their reaction was very curious. Rather than engaging him in battle or shouting silly demands for him to lay down his arms, they glanced about the room in confusion, weapons drooping. One man went to the window and leaned outside.
"Hey, you've been watching this place or taking a nap?"
The guards in the street hollered something back.
Blaze had moved inside the front wall and was now exchanging a series of expressions with Min, who stood against the eastern wall. Her shimmery face was hard to read, but she looked as shocked as he was. There was a note of something else in her glowing eyes, too. Something that looked an awful lot like pride. Blaze had already figured it out. He was shadow walking, but he didn't have time to dwell on that while the room was half full of guards stumbling about and stabbing at the mattresses. Anyway, he suspected if he gave it too much thought he might quit doing it, and then there'd really be trouble. A guard stood in the doorway, gripping both sides of the frame and blinking at the others as they thumped around, knocking on walls for false doors, or just to spread their misery to the guests in the neighboring rooms. Sooner or later, one of them was going to bump into Blaze. He wasn't certain if that would do anything, but based on the fact Min couldn't walk through walls or the like, he didn't want to find out. He edged toward the door, careful not to let his soles scuff, though the floor didn't quite feel as hard as normal. And if he was bumbling about in the nether, he didn't know if it was possible for his shoes to scuff, or why they, like his clothes and swords, had followed him into it. He sheathed his swords, clamped his arms against his sides, and stood as straight as possible, minimizing his physical presence.
"You're sure they were here?"
one of the men said.
"This was where he told them to meet," another replied. "The boys in the street confirmed they came inside. Haven't seen shit since."
The soldier was still blocking the door. Blaze picked up an unlit candle from the shelf and flung it across the room. A couple of the troops cried out. The one in the doorway gasped, drew his sword, and advanced inside. Blaze didn't waste a moment. On his way out, he nearly crashed into another man who'd stayed back to watch the hall. Blaze stopped himself short and edged around the soldier. Though the hallway had very little light, it was after dark. There was one lone window in the far wall, and a mere 2 candles burned from the sconces. Blaze could see perfectly fine. Min followed him out. She grabbed his hand. Her skin was as cool as the underside of a stone.
She took him down the stairs and through the common room, where men stared at the ceiling, murmuring to each other about the arrests upstairs. Reflexively, Blaze glanced up too.